and the good doctor understood that he wished to behold his child. He therefore approached the bed, and while his companion was dipping the fingers with which he had touched the lips of the corpse in chloride of lime, he uncovered that calm and pale face which looked like that of a sleeping angel. A tear, which appeared in the old man's eye, expressed his thanks to the doctor. The doctor of the dead then laid his procès-verbal on the corner of the table, and having executed his office, was conducted out by d'Avrigny. Fifor met them at the door of his study. Having in a few words thanked the district doctor, he returned to d'Avrigny and said, "And now the priest." "Is there any particular priest you wish to pray with, Valentine?" asked d'Avrigny. "No," said Vifor. "Fetch the nearest." "The nearest," said the district doctor, "is a good Italian abbe who lives next door to you. Shall I call on him as I pass?" "D'Avrigny," said Vifor, "be so kind, I beseech you, as to accompany this gentleman. Here is the key of the door, so that you can go in and out as you please. You will bring the priest with you, and will oblige me by introducing him into my child's room." "Do you wish to see him?" "I only wish to be alone." "You will excuse me, will you not? A priest can understand a father's grief." And Monsieur de Vifor, giving the key to d'Avrigny, again bade farewell to the strange doctor and retired to his study, where he began to work. For some temperaments, work is a remedy for all afflictions. As the doctors entered the street, they saw a man in a cassock standing on the threshold of the next door. "This is the abbe of whom I spoke," said the doctor to d'Avrigny. D'Avrigny accosted the priest. "Sir," he said, "are you disposed to confer a great obligation on an unhappy father who has just lost his daughter? I mean Monsieur de Vifor, the procureur du roi. The servants who fled from the house informed me of the death of the young girl. I also know that her name is Valentine, and I have already prayed for her." "Thank you, sir," said d'Avrigny. "Since you have commenced your sacred office, deign to continue it. Come and watch by the dead, and all the wretched family will be grateful to you." "I am going, sir, and I do not hesitate to say that no prayers will be more fervent than mine." D'Avrigny took the priest's hand, and without meeting Vifor, who was engaged in his study, they reached Valentine's room, which on the following night was to be occupied by the undertakers. On entering the room, Noirtier's eyes met those of the abbe, and no doubt he read some particular expression in them, for he remained in the room. D'Avrigny recommended the attention of the priest to the living as well as to the dead, and the abbe promised to devote his prayers to Valentine and his attentions to Noirtier. In order, doubtless, that he might not be disturbed while fulfilling his sacred mission, the priest, as soon as d'Avrigny departed, rose and not only bolted the door through which the doctor had just left, but also that leading to Madame de Vifor's room. 105. Danglars' signature. The next morning rose dull and cloudy. During the night the undertakers had executed their melancholy office and folded the corpse in the winding sheet, which, whatever may be said about the equality of death, is at least a last proof of the luxury so pleasing in life. During the evening, two men, engaged for the purpose, had carried Noirtier from Valentine's room into his own, and, contrary to all expectation, there was no difficulty in withdrawing him from his child. The Abbe Busoni had watched till daylight, and then left without calling anyone. D'Avrigny returned about 8 o'clock in the morning. He met Vifor on his way to Noirtier's room, and accompanied him to see how the old man had slept. They found him in the large armchair, which served him for a bed, enjoying a calm, nay, almost a smiling sleep. They both stood in amazement at the door. "See," said d'Avrigny to Vifor, "nature knows how to alleviate the deepest sorrow. No one can say Mishanwate did not love his child, and yet he sleeps.
Yes, you are right, replied Vifor, surprised. He sleeps indeed, and this is the more strange, since the least contradiction keeps him awake all night.
Grief has stunned him, replied d'Avrigny, and they both returned thoughtfully to the study of the Procureur du Roi.
See, I have not slept, said Vifor, showing his undisturbed bed. Grief does not stun me. I have not been in bed for 2 nights. But then look at my desk. See what I have written during these 2 days and nights. I have filled those papers and have made out the accusation against the assassin Benedetto. Oh, work, work, my passion, my joy, my delight. It is for thee to alleviate my sorrows. And he convulsively grasped the hand of d'Avrigny.
Do you require my services now? Asked d'Avrigny.
No, said Vifor. Only return again at 11 o'clock. At 12 the... Oh, heavens, my poor, poor child!
And the Procureur du Roi, again becoming a man, lifted up his eyes and groaned.
Shall you be present in the reception room? No, I have a cousin who has undertaken this sad office. I shall work, doctor. When I work, I forget everything.
And indeed, no sooner had the doctor left the room than he was again absorbed in study. On the doorstep, d'Avrigny met the cousin whom Vifor had mentioned. He was punctual, dressed in black with crepe around his hat, and presented himself at his cousin's with a face made up for the occasion, and which he could alter as might be required. At 12 o'clock the morning coaches rolled into the paved court, and the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré was filled with a crowd of idlers, equally pleased to witness the festivities or the mourning of the rich, and who rush with the same avidity to a funeral procession as to the marriage of a duchess. Gradually the reception room filled, and some of our old friends made their appearance. We mean Debray, Chateau Renaud, and Beauchamp, accompanied by all the leading men of the day at the bar, in literature or the army, for Monsieur de Vifor moved in the first Parisian circles, less owing to his social position than to his personal merit. Those who were acquainted soon formed into little groups. One of these was composed of Debray, Chateau Renaud, and Beauchamp.
"Poor girl," said Debray, like the rest, paying an involuntary tribute to the sad event. Poor girl! So young, so rich, so beautiful! Could you have imagined this scene, Chateau Renaud, when we saw her, at the most 3 weeks ago, about to sign that contract?
Indeed, no, said Chateau Renaud.
Did you know her?
I spoke to her once or twice at Madame de Morcerf's, amongst the rest. She appeared to me charming, though rather melancholy.
Where is her stepmother, do you know? She is spending the day with the wife of the worthy gentleman who is receiving us.
Dr. d'Avrigny, who attends my mother, said Chateau Renaud, declares that the Procureur du Roi is in despair.
But whom are you seeking, Debray? I am seeking the Count of Monte Cristo, said the young man.
I met him on the boulevard, on my road here, said Beauchamp. I think he is about to leave Paris. He was going to his banker.
His banker? Danglars is his banker, is he not? Asked Chateau Renaud of Debray.
I believe so, replied the secretary, with slight uneasiness. But Monte Cristo is not the only one I miss here. I do not see Morel.
Morel? Do they know him? Asked Chateau Renaud. I think he has only been introduced to Madame de Vifor.
Still, he ought to have been here, said Debray. I wonder what will be talked about tonight. This funeral is the news of the day. But hush, here comes our Minister of Justice. He will feel obliged to make some little speech to the cousin.
And the three young men drew near to listen. Beauchamp told the truth when he said that on his road to the funeral he had met Monte Cristo, who was directing his steps towards the Rue de la Chaussée-d'Antin to Monsieur Danglars. The banker saw the carriage of the Count enter the courtyard and advanced to meet him with a sad though affable smile.
"Well," said he, extending his hand to Monte Cristo, "I suppose you have come to sympathize with me, for indeed misfortune has taken possession of my house. When I perceived you, I was just saying that a number of my acquaintances have been very unfortunate this year. For example, look at the puritanical procureur du roi, who has just lost his daughter, and in fact nearly all his family in so singular a manner. Morcerf, dishonored and dead, and then myself, covered with ridicule through the villainy of Benedetto. Besides..."
"Besides what?" asked the Count.
"Alas, do you not know? What new calamity? My daughter Eugénie has left us. Good heavens, what are you telling me? The truth, my dear Count. Oh, how happy you must be in not having either wife or children."
"Do you think so?"
"And so, Mademoiselle Danglars, she could not endure the insult offered to us by that wretch, so she asked permission to travel."
"And is she gone?"
"The other night she left."
"With Madame Danglars?"
"No, with a relation. But still, we have quite lost our dear Eugénie, for I doubt whether her pride will ever allow her to return to France."
"Still, Baron," said Monte Cristo, "family griefs, or indeed any other affliction which would crush a man whose child was his only treasure, are endurable to a millionaire. Philosophers may well say, and practical men will always support the opinion, that money mitigates many trials. And if you admit the efficacy of this sovereign balm, you ought to be very easily consoled. You, the king of finance, who form the intersecting point of all the powers in Europe, nay, the world." Danglars smiled at the good-natured pleasantry of the Count.
"That reminds me," he said, "that when you entered, I was on the point of signing 5 little bonds. I have already signed 2. Will you allow me to do the same to the others?"
"Pray do so." There was a moment's silence, during which the noise of the banker's pen was alone heard, while Monte Cristo examined the gilt mouldings of the ceiling. "Are they Spanish, Haitian, or Neapolitan bonds?" said Monte Cristo.
"Neither," said Danglars, smiling. "They are bonds on the Bank of France, payable to the bearer. Stay," he added, "Count, you, who may be called the Emperor, if I claim the title of King of Finance, have you many pieces of paper of this size, each worth 1,000,000?
The Count took the papers which Danglars had so proudly presented to him into his hands and read, "To the Governor of the Bank, please to pay to my order from the fund deposited by me the sum of 1,000,000, Baron Danglars."
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, said Monte Cristo.
5 millions? Why, what a Croesus you are!"
"This is how I transact business," said Danglars.
"It is really wonderful," said the Count, "above all if, as I suppose, it is payable at sight."
"It is, indeed," said Danglars.
"It is a fine thing to have such credit. Really, it is only in France these things are done. 5 millions on 5 little scraps of paper. It must be seen to be believed."
"Well, you shall be convinced. Take my clerk to the bank, and you will see him leave it with an order on the treasury for the same sum."
"No," said Monte Cristo, folding the 5 notes. Most decidedly not. The thing is so curious, I will make the experiment myself. I am credited on you for 6 millions. I have drawn 900,000 francs. You, therefore, still owe me 5,100,000 francs. I will take the 5 scraps of paper that I now hold as bonds with your signature alone, and here is a receipt in full for the 6 millions between us. I had prepared it beforehand, for I am much in want of money today. And Monte Cristo placed the bonds in his pocket with one hand, while with the other he held out the receipt to Danglars. If a thunderbolt had fallen at the banker's feet, he could not have experienced greater terror.
What? He stammered. Do you mean to take that money? Excuse me, but I owe this money to the hospital, a deposit which I promised to pay this morning.
Oh, well then, said Monte Cristo, I am not particular about these 5 notes. Pay me in a different form. I wished, from curiosity, to take these that I might be able to say that without any advice or preparation the House of Danglars had paid me 5 millions without a minute's delay. It would have been so remarkable. But here are your bonds. Pay me differently. And he held the bonds towards Danglars, who seized them like a vulture, extending its claws to withhold the food, attempted to be wrested from it. Suddenly he rallied, made a violent effort to restrain himself, and then a smile gradually widened the features of his disturbed countenance.
Certainly, he said, your receipt is money.
Oh, dear, yes. And if you were at Rome, the House of Thompson and French would make no more difficulty about paying the money on my receipt than you have just done.
Pardon me, Count. Pardon me.
Then I may keep this money.
Yes, said Danglars,
while the perspiration started from the roots of his hair.
Yes, keep it. Keep it.
Monte Cristo replaced the notes in his pocket with that indescribable expression which seemed to say, Come, reflect. If you repent, there is still time.
No, said Danglars. No, decidedly no. Keep my signatures. But you know none are so formal as bankers in transacting business. I intended this money for the hospitals, and I seemed to be robbing them if I did not pay them with these precise bonds. How absurd! As if one crown were not as good as another. Excuse me. And he began to laugh loudly, but nervously.
Certainly I excuse you, said Monte Cristo graciously, and pocket them. And he placed the bonds in his pocket-book.
But, said Danglars, there is still a sum of 100,000 francs.
Oh, a mere nothing, said Monte Cristo. The balance would come to about that sum. But keep it, and we shall be quits.
Count, said Danglars, are you speaking seriously?
I never joke with bankers, said Monte Cristo in a freezing manner which repelled impertinence. And he turned towards the door, just as the valet de chambre announced, Monsieur de Beauvie, receiver general of the hospitals.
Ma foi, said Monte Cristo, I think I arrived just in time to obtain your signatures, or they would have been disputed with me.
Danglars again became pale and hastened to conduct the count out. Monte Cristo exchanged a ceremonious bow with Monsieur de Beauvie, who was standing in the waiting room and who was introduced into Danglars' room as soon as the count had left. The count's sad face was illumined by a faint smile as he noticed the portfolio which the receiver general held in his hand. At the door he found his carriage and was immediately driven to the bank. Meanwhile, Danglars, repressing all emotion, advanced to meet the receiver general.
Good morning, creditor, said he, for I wager anything it is the creditor who visits me.
You are right, Baron, answered Monsieur de Beauvie.
The hospitals present themselves to you through me. The widows and orphans depute me to receive alms to the amount of 5 millions from you.
And yet they say orphans are to be pitied, said Danglars, wishing to prolong the jest. Poor things!
Here I am in their name, said Monsieur de Beauvy. But did you receive my letter yesterday?
Yes, I have brought my receipt. My dear Monsieur de Beauvy, your widows and orphans must oblige me by waiting 24 hours, since Monsieur de Monte Cristo, whom you just saw leaving here, you did see him, I think.
Yes. Well,
well, Monsieur de Monte Cristo has just carried off their 5 millions.
How so? The Count had unlimited credit upon me, a credit opened by Thompson and French of Rome. He came to demand 5 millions at once, which I paid him with checks on the bank. My funds are deposited there, and you can understand that if I draw out 10 millions on the same day, it will appear rather strange to the governor. 2 days will be a different thing, said Danglars, smiling.
Come, said Beauvy, with a tone of entire incredulity. 5 millions to that gentleman who just left, and who bowed to me as though he knew me.
Perhaps he knows you, though you do not know him. Monsieur de Monte Cristo knows everybody. 5 millions? Here is his receipt. Believe your own eyes.
Monsieur de Beauvy took the paper Danglars presented him and read, Received of Baron Danglars the sum of 5,100,000 francs, which will be repaid whenever he pleases by the house of Thompson and French of Rome.
It is really true, said de Beauvy. Do you know the house of Thompson and French?
Yes. I once had business to transact with it to the amount of 200,000 francs, but since then I have not heard it mentioned.
It is one of the best houses in Europe, said Danglars, carelessly throwing down the receipt on his desk. And he had 5 millions in your hands alone? Why, this Count of Monte Cristo must be a nabob.
Indeed, I do not know what he is. He has 3 unlimited credits, one on me, one on Rothschild, one on Lafitte. And you see, he added carelessly, he has given me the preference by leaving a balance of 100,000 francs.
Monsieur de Beauvy manifested signs of extraordinary admiration.
I must visit him, he said, and obtain some pious grant from him. Oh, you may make sure of him. His charities alone amount to 20,000 francs per month. It is magnificent. I will set before him the example of Madame de Morcerf and her son. What example? They gave all their fortune to the hospitals. For what reason? Because they would not spend money so guiltily acquired. And what are they to live upon? The mother retires into the country, and the son enters the army. And how much did they possess? Oh, not much. From 1,200 to 1,300,000 francs. But to return to our millions, certainly, said Danglars, in the most natural tone in the world. Are you then pressed for this money?
Yes, for the examination of our cash takes place tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Why did you not tell me so before? Why, it is as good as a century. At what hour does the examination take place?
At 2 o'clock. Send at 12, said Danglars, smiling.
Monsieur de Beauvy said nothing, but nodded his head and took up the portfolio.
Now I think of it, you can do better, said Danglars.
How do you mean? The receipt of Monsieur de Monte Cristo is as good as money. Take it to Rothschild's or Lafitte's, and they will take it off you directly.
What, though payable at Rome?
Certainly. It will only cost you a discount of 5,000 or 6,000 francs.
The receiver started back.
Ma foi, he said. I prefer waiting till tomorrow. What a proposition!
I thought, perhaps, said Danglars, with supreme impertinence, that you had a deficiency to make up.
Indeed, said the receiver,
and if that were the case, it would be worthwhile to make some sacrifice.
Thank you.
No, sir.
Then it will be tomorrow.
Yes, I shall come myself.
Be it so. It will afford me the pleasure of seeing you again.
They shook hands.
By the way, said Monsieur de Beauvais, are you not going to the funeral of poor Mademoiselle de Villefort, which I met on my road here?
No, said the banker. I have appeared rather ridiculous since that affair of Benedetto, so I remain in the background.
Everybody pities you, sir. And above all, Mademoiselle Danglars.
Poor Eugénie, said Danglars. Do you know she is going to embrace a religious life?
No, alas, it is unhappily but too true. The day after the event, she decided on leaving Paris with a nun of her acquaintance. They are gone to seek a very strict convent in Italy or Spain.
How, it is terrible!
And Monsieur de Beauvais retired with this exclamation, after expressing acute sympathy with the father. But he had scarcely left before Danglars, with an energy of action those can alone understand who have seen Robert Macaire represented by Frédéric, exclaimed,
"Fool!"
Then, enclosing Monte Cristo's receipt in a little pocket-book, he added,
"Yes, come at 12 o'clock. I shall then be far away."
Then he double-locked his door, emptied all his drawers, collected about 50,000 francs in banknotes, burned several papers, left others exposed to view, and then commenced writing a letter which he addressed
to Madame la Baronne Danglars. "I will place it on her table myself tonight," he murmured.
Then, taking a passport from his drawer, he said,
"Good. It is available for 2 months longer."
106. The Cemetery of Père Lachaise. Monsieur de Beauvais had indeed met the funeral procession which conducted Valentine to her last home on earth. The weather was dull and stormy. A cold wind shook the few remaining yellow leaves from the boughs of the trees and scattered them amongst the crowd which filled the boulevard. Monsieur de Beaufort, a true Parisian, considered the cemetery of Père Lachaise alone worthy of receiving the mortal remains of a Parisian family. He had therefore purchased a vault, which was quickly occupied by members of his family. On the front of the monument was inscribed, "The families of Saint-Marin and Villefort," for such had been the last wish expressed by poor Renée, Valentine's mother. The pompous procession, therefore, wended its way towards Père Lachaise from the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. More than 50 private carriages followed the 20 mourning coaches, and behind them more than 500 persons joined the procession on foot. These last consisted of all the young people whom Valentine's death had struck like a thunderbolt, and who, notwithstanding the raw chilliness of the season, could not refrain from paying a last tribute to the memory of the beautiful, chaste, and adorable girl thus cut off in the flower of her youth. As they left Paris, an equipage with 4 horses at full speed was seen to draw up suddenly. It contained Monte Cristo. The Count left the carriage and mingled in the crowd who followed on foot. Château Renaud perceived him, and immediately alighting from his coupé joined him. The Count looked attentively through every opening in the crowd. He was evidently watching for someone, but his search ended in disappointment. "Where is Morel?" he asked. "Do either of these gentlemen know where he is?" "We have already asked that question," said Château Renaud, "for none of us have seen him." The Count was silent, but continued to gaze around him. At length they arrived at the cemetery. The piercing eye of Monte Cristo glanced through clusters of bushes and trees, and was soon relieved from all anxiety, for he saw a shadow glide between the yew trees, and Monte Cristo recognized him whom he sought. This shadow passed rapidly behind the tomb of Abelard and Eloise, and placed itself close to the horses' heads belonging to the hearse, and, following the undertaker's men, arrived with them at the spot appointed for the burial. Each person's attention was occupied. Monte Cristo saw nothing but the shadow, which no one else observed. Twice the Count left the ranks to see whether the object of his interest had any concealed weapon beneath his clothes. When the procession stopped, this shadow was recognized as Morel, who, with his coat buttoned up to his throat, his face livid, and convulsively crushing his hat between his fingers, leaned against a tree situated on an elevation commanding the mausoleum, so that none of the funeral details could escape his observation. Everything was conducted in the usual manner. Monte Cristo heard and saw nothing, or rather, he only saw Morel, whose calmness had a frightful effect on those who knew what was passing in his heart.
"See," said Beauchamp, pointing out Morel to Debray, "what is he doing up there?"
And they called Château Renaud's attention to him.
"How pale he is," said Château Renaud, shuddering.
"He is cold," said Debray.
"Not at all," said Château Renaud slowly. "I think he is violently agitated. He is very susceptible."
"Bah," said Debray, "he scarcely knew Mademoiselle de Villefort. You said so yourself."
"True. Still, I remember he danced 3 times with her at Madame de Morcerf's. Do you recollect that ball, Count, where you produced such an effect?"
"No, I do not," replied Monte Cristo, without even knowing of what or to whom he was speaking, so much was he occupied in watching Morel, who was holding his breath with emotion.
"The discourse is over. Farewell, gentlemen," said the Count, and he disappeared without anyone seeing whither he went. The funeral being over, the guests returned to Paris. Château Renaud looked for a moment for Morel, but while watching the departure of the Count, Morel had quitted his post, and Château Renaud, failing in his search, joined Debray and Beauchamp. Monte Cristo concealed himself behind a large tomb, and waited the arrival of Morel, who, by degrees, approached the tomb now abandoned by spectators and workmen. Morel threw a glance around, but before it reached the spot occupied by Monte Cristo, the latter had advanced yet nearer, still unperceived. The young man knelt down. The Count, with outstretched neck and glaring eyes, stood in an attitude ready to pounce upon Morel upon the first occasion. Morel bent his head till it touched the stone, then, clutching the grating with both hands, he murmured,
"Oh, Valentine!"
The Count's heart was pierced by the utterance of these 2 words. He stepped forward, and touching the young man's shoulder, said, "I was looking for you, my friend." Monte Cristo expected a burst of passion, but he was deceived, for Morel, turning round, said with calmness,
"You see, I was praying."
The scrutinizing glance of the Count searched the young man from head to foot. He then seemed more easy.
"Shall I drive you back to Paris?" he asked.
"No, thank you. Do you wish anything?"
"Leave me to pray."
The Count withdrew without opposition, but it was only to place himself in a situation where he could watch every movement of Morel, who at length rose, brushed the dust from his knees, and turned towards Paris without once looking back. He walked slowly down the Rue de la Roguette. The Count, dismissing his carriage, followed him about 100 paces behind. Maximilian crossed the canal and entered the Rue Mellet by the boulevards. 5 minutes after the door had been closed on Morel's entrance, it was again opened for the Count. Julie was at the entrance of the garden, where she was attentively watching Penelon, who, entering with zeal into his profession of a gardener, was very busy grafting some Bengal roses.
"Ah, Count!" she exclaimed, with the delight manifested by every member of the family whenever he visited the Rue Malais.
"Maximilian has just returned, has he not, madame?" asked the Count.
"Yes, I think I saw him pass. But pray, call Emmanuel.
Excuse me, madame, but I must go up to Maximilian's room this instant," replied Monte Cristo. "I have something of the greatest importance to tell him."
"Go, then," she said, with a charming smile which accompanied him until he had disappeared.
Monte Cristo soon ran up the staircase conducting from the ground floor to Maximilian's room. When he reached the landing, he listened attentively, but all was still. Like many old houses occupied by a single family, the room door was panelled with glass, but it was locked. Maximilian was shut in, and it was impossible to see what was passing in the room, owing to a red curtain being drawn before the glass. The Count's anxiety was manifested by a bright colour which seldom appeared on the face of that impassible man. "What shall I do?" he uttered, and reflected for a moment. "Shall I ring?" "No. The sound of a bell announcing a visitor will but accelerate the resolution of one in Maximilian's situation, and then the bell would be followed by a louder noise." Monte Cristo trembled from head to foot, and, as if his determination had been taken with the rapidity of lightning, he struck one of the panes of glass with his elbow. The glass was shivered to atoms. Then, withdrawing the curtain, he saw Morel, who had been writing at his desk, bound from his seat at the noise of the broken window.
"I beg 1,000 pardons," said the Count. "There is nothing the matter, but I slipped down and broke one of your panes of glass with my elbow. Since it is open, I will take advantage of it to enter your room. Do not disturb yourself, do not disturb yourself."
And passing his hand through the broken glass, the Count opened a door. Morel, evidently discomposed, came to meet Monte Cristo, less with the intention of receiving him than to exclude his entry.
"Ma foi," said Monte Cristo, rubbing his elbow, "it's all your servant's fault. Your stairs are so polished, it is like walking on glass."
"Are you hurt, sir?" coldly asked Morel.
"I believe not. But what are you about there? You were writing."
"I? Your fingers are stained with ink."
"Ah, true. I was writing. I do sometimes, soldier though I am."
Monte Cristo advanced into the room. Maximilian was obliged to let him pass, but he followed him.
"You were writing?" said Monte Cristo with a searching look.
"I have already had the honour of telling you I was," said Morel. The Count looked around him. "Your pistols are beside your desk," said Monte Cristo, pointing with his finger to the pistols on the table.
"I am on the point of starting on a journey," replied Morel disdainfully.
"My friend," exclaimed Monte Cristo in a tone of exquisite sweetness.
"Sir?"
"My friend, my dear Maximilian, do not make a hasty resolution, I entreat you."
"I make a hasty resolution?" said Morel, shrugging his shoulders. "Is there anything extraordinary in a journey?"
"Maximilian," said the Count, "let us both lay aside the mask we have assumed. You no more deceive me with that false calmness than I impose upon you with my frivolous solicitude. You can understand, can you not, that to have acted as I have done, to have broken those windows, to have intruded on the solicitude of a friend, you can understand that to have done all this, I must have been actuated by real uneasiness, or rather by a terrible conviction. Morel, you are going to destroy yourself."
"Indeed, Count," said Morel, shuddering. "What has put this into your head?"
"I tell you that you are about to destroy yourself," continued the Count, "and here is the proof of what I say." And approaching the desk, he removed the sheet of paper which Morel had placed over the letter he had begun, and took the letter in his hands. Morel rushed forward to tear it from him, but Monte Cristo, perceiving his intention, seized his wrist with his iron grasp.
"You wish to destroy yourself," said the Count. "You have written it."
"Well," said Morel, changing his expression of calmness for one of violence. "Well, and if I do intend to turn this pistol against myself, who shall prevent me? Who will dare prevent me? All my hopes are blighted. My heart is broken, my life a burden. Everything around me is sad and mournful. Earth has become distasteful to me, and human voices distract me. It is a mercy to let me die, for if I live I shall lose my reason and become mad. When, sir, I tell you all this with tears of heartfelt anguish, can you reply that I am wrong? Can you prevent my putting an end to my miserable existence? Tell me, sir, could you have the courage to do so? Yes, Morrel, said Monte Cristo, with a calmness which contrasted strangely with the young man's excitement. Yes, I would do so. You! Exclaimed Morrel, with increasing anger and reproach. You, who have deceived me with false hopes, who have cheered and soothed me with vain promises, when I might, if not have saved her, at least have seen her die in my arms. You, who pretend to understand everything, even the hidden sources of knowledge. You, who enact the part of a guardian angel upon earth and could not even find an antidote to a poison administered to a young girl. Ah, sir, indeed you would inspire me with pity were you not hateful in my eyes. Morrel, yes, you tell me to lay aside the mask, and I will do so. Be satisfied. When you spoke to me at the cemetery, I answered you my heart was softened. When you arrived here, I allowed you to enter. But since you abuse my confidence, since you have devised a new torture after I thought I had exhausted them all, then, Count of Monte Cristo, my pretended benefactor, then, Count of Monte Cristo, the universal guardian, be satisfied. You shall witness the death of your friend. And Morrel, with a maniacal laugh, again rushed towards the pistols. And I again repeat, you shall not commit suicide. Prevent me, then, replied Morrel, with another struggle which, like the first, failed in releasing him from the Count's iron grasp. I will prevent you. And who are you, then, that arrogate to yourself this tyrannical right over free and rational beings? Who am I? Repeated Monte Cristo. Listen. I am the only man in the world having the right to say to you, Morrel, your father's son shall not die today. And Monte Cristo, with an expression of majesty and sublimity, advanced with his arms folded towards the young man, who, involuntarily overcome by the command of this man, recoiled a step. "Why do you mention my father?" stammered he. "Why do you mingle a recollection of him with the affairs of today? Because I am he who saved your father's life when he wished to destroy himself as you do today, because I am the man who sent the purse to your young sister and the Pharaon to old Morrel, because I am the Edmond Dantès who nursed you, a child, on my knees." Morrel made another step back, staggering, breathless, crushed. Then all his strength gave way, and he fell prostrate at the feet of Monte Cristo. Then his admirable nature underwent a complete and sudden revulsion. He rose, bounded out of the room, and rushed to the stairs, exclaiming energetically, "Julie! Julie! Emmanuel! Emmanuel!" Monte Cristo endeavoured also to leave, but Maximilian would have died rather than relax his hold on the handle of the door, which he closed upon the Count. Julie, Emmanuel, and some of the servants ran up in alarm on hearing the cries of Maximilian. Morrel seized their hands, and opening the door, exclaimed in a voice choked with sobs, "On your knees! On your knees! He is our benefactor, the saviour of our father. He is..." He would have added Edmond Dantès, but the Count seized his arm and prevented him. Julie threw herself into the arms of the Count. Emmanuel embraced him as a guardian angel. Morrel again fell on his knees and struck the ground with his forehead. Then the iron-hearted man felt his heart swell in his breast. A flame seemed to rush from his throat to his eyes. He bent his head and wept. For a while, nothing was heard in the room but a succession of sobs, while the incense from their grateful hearts mounted to heaven. Julie had scarcely recovered from her deep emotion when she rushed out of the room, descended to the next floor, ran into the drawing room with childlike joy, and raised the crystal globe which covered the purse given by the unknown of the Allée des Meilleurs. Meanwhile, Emmanuel, in a broken voice, said to the Count,
"Oh, Count, how could you, hearing us so often speak of our unknown benefactor, seeing us pay such homage of gratitude and adoration to his memory, how could you continue so long without discovering yourself to us? Oh, it was cruel to us, and dare I say it, to you also."
"Listen, my friend," said the Count. "I may call you so, since we have really been friends for the last 11 years. The discovery of this secret has been occasioned by a great event which you must never know. I wished to bury it during my whole life in my own bosom, but your brother, Maximilian, wrested it from me by a violence he repents of now, I am sure." Then turning round and seeing that Morel, still on his knees, had thrown himself into an armchair, he added in a low voice, pressing Emmanuel's hand significantly, "Watch over him."
"Why so?" asked the young man, surprised. "I cannot explain myself, but watch over him."
Emmanuel looked round the room and caught sight of the pistols. His eyes rested on the arms, and he pointed to them. Monte Cristo bent his head. Emmanuel went towards the pistols.
"Leave them," said Monte Cristo.
Then, walking towards Morel, he took his hand. The tumultuous agitation of the young man was succeeded by a profound stupor. Julie returned, holding in her hands the silken purse, while tears of joy rolled down her cheeks like dewdrops on the rose.
"Here is the relic," she said. "Do not think it will be less dear to us now we are acquainted with our benefactor."
"My child," said Monte Cristo, colouring, "allow me to take back that purse. Since you now know my face, I wish to be remembered alone through the affection I hope you will grant me."
"Oh," said Julie, pressing the purse to her heart, "no, no, I beseech you, do not take it. For some unhappy day you will leave us, will you not?"
"You have guessed rightly, madame," replied Monte Cristo, smiling. "In a week I shall have left this country, where so many persons who merit the vengeance of heaven lived happily, while my father perished of hunger and grief." While announcing his departure, the Count fixed his eyes on Morel and remarked that the words, "I shall have left this country," had failed to rouse him from his lethargy. He then saw that he must make another struggle against the grief of his friend, and taking the hands of Emmanuel and Julie, which he pressed within his own, he said with the mild authority of a father, "My kind friends, leave me alone with Maximilian." Julie saw the means offered of carrying off her precious relic, which Monte Cristo had forgotten. She drew her husband to the door.
"Let us leave them," she said.
The Count was alone with Morel, who remained motionless as a statue.
"Come," said Monte Cristo, touching his shoulder with his finger.
"Are you a man again, Maximilian?"
"Yes. For I begin to suffer again."
The Count frowned, apparently in gloomy hesitation.
"Maximilian, Maximilian," he said, "the ideas you yield to are unworthy of a Christian."
"Oh, do not fear, my friend," said Morel, raising his head and smiling with a sweet expression on the Count. "I shall no longer attempt my life."
"Then we are to have no more pistols, no more arms?"
"No. I have found a better remedy for my grief than either a bullet or knife."
"Poor fellow.
What is it?"
"My grief will kill me of itself."
"My friend," said Monte Cristo, with an expression of melancholy equal to his own, "listen to me. One day, in a moment of despair, like yours, since it led to a similar resolution, I, like you, wished to kill myself. One day your father, equally desperate, wished to kill himself too. If anyone had said to your father at the moment he raised the pistol to his head, if anyone had told me when in my prison I pushed back the food I had not tasted for 3 days, if anyone had said to either of us then, live, the day will come when you will be happy and will bless life, no matter whose voice had spoken, we should have heard him with the smile of doubt or the anguish of incredulity. And yet how many times has your father blessed life while embracing you? How often have I myself... Ah, exclaimed Morel, interrupting the count, you had only lost your liberty. My father had only lost his fortune, but I have lost Valentine. Look at me, said Monte Cristo, with that expression which sometimes made him so eloquent and persuasive. Look at me. There are no tears in my eyes, nor is there fever in my veins. Yet I see you suffer. You, Maximilian, whom I love as my own son. Well, does not this tell you that in grief as in life, there is always something to look forward to beyond? Now, if I entreat, if I order you to live, Morel, it is in the conviction that one day you will thank me for having preserved your life. Oh, heavens, said the young man, oh, heavens, what are you saying, Count? Take care, but perhaps you have never loved. Child, replied the Count, I mean as I love. You see, I have been a soldier ever since I attained manhood. I reached the age of 29 without loving, for none of the feelings I before then experienced merit the appellation of love. Well, at 29 I saw Valentine. During 2 years I have loved her. During 2 years I have seen, written in her heart as in a book, all the virtues of a daughter and wife. Count, to possess Valentine would have been a happiness too infinite, too ecstatic, too complete, too divine for this world, since it has been denied me. But without Valentine, the earth is desolate. I have told you to hope, said the Count. Then have a care, I repeat, for you seek to persuade me, and if you succeed I should lose my reason, for I should hope that I could again behold Valentine. The Count smiled. My friend, my father, said Morel with excitement, have a care, I again repeat, for the power you wield over me alarms me. Weigh your words before you speak, for my eyes have already become brighter and my heart rebounds. Be cautious, or you will make me believe in supernatural agencies. I must obey you, so, in mercy, be cautious. Hope, my friend, repeated the Count. Ah, said Morel, falling from the height of excitement to the abyss of despair. Ah, you are playing with me, like those good or rather selfish mothers who soothe their children with honeyed words because their screams annoy them. No, my friend, I was wrong to caution you. Do not fear. I will bury my grief so deep in my heart, I will disguise it so that you shall not even care to sympathize with me. Adieu, my friend, adieu.
On the contrary, said the Count, after this time you must live with me. You must not leave me, and in a week we shall have left France behind us. And you still bid me hope? I tell you to hope, because I have a method of curing you. Count, you render me sadder than before, if it be possible. You think the result of this blow has been to produce an ordinary grief, and you would cure it by an ordinary remedy, change of scene. And Morel dropped his head with disdainful incredulity. What can I say more? Asked Monte Cristo. I have confidence in the remedy I propose, and only ask you to permit me to assure you of its efficacy. Count, you prolong my agony. Then, said the Count, your feeble spirit will not even grant me the trial I request. Come, do you know of what the Count of Monte Cristo is capable? Do you know that he holds terrestrial beings under his control? Nay, that he can almost work a miracle? Well, wait for the miracle I hope to accomplish. Or?
Repeated Morel.
Or take care, Morel, lest I call you ungrateful. Have pity on me, Count. I feel so much pity towards you, Maximilian, that listen to me attentively. If I do not cure you in a month, to the day, to the very hour, mark my words, Morel, I will place loaded pistols before you, and a cup full of the deadliest Italian poison, a poison more sure and prompt than that which has killed Valentine.
Will you promise me?
Yes, for I am a man, and have suffered like yourself, and also contemplated suicide. Indeed, often since misfortune has left me, I have longed for the delights of an eternal sleep.
But you are sure you will promise me this? Said Morel, intoxicated.
I not only promise, but swear it, said Monte Cristo, extending his hand.
In a month, then, on your honour, if I am not consoled, you will let me take my life into my own hands, and whatever may happen, you will not call me ungrateful?
In a month, to the day, the very hour, and the date is a sacred one, Maximilian. I do not know whether you remember that this is the 5th of September. It is 10 years today since I saved your father's life, who wished to die. Morel seized the Count's hand and kissed it. The Count allowed him to pay the homage he felt due to him. In a month, you will find on the table, at which we shall be then sitting, good pistols and a delicious draught. But on the other hand, you must promise me not to attempt your life before that time.
Oh, I also swear it.
Monte Cristo drew the young man towards him and pressed him for some time to his heart.
And now, he said, after today, you will come and live with me. You can occupy Ade's apartment, and my daughter will at least be replaced by my son.
Ade, said Morel, what has become of her?
She departed last night.
To leave you?
To wait for me.
Hold yourself ready, then, to join me at the Champs-Élysées, and lead me out of this house without anyone seeing my departure.
Maximilian hung his head and obeyed with childlike reverence.
107. The Division. The first floor of the house in the Rue Saint-Germain-des-Prés, chosen by Albert and Madame de Morcerf for their residence, consisting of one room, was let to a very mysterious person. This was a man whose face the concierge himself had never seen, for in the winter his chin was buried in one of those large red handkerchiefs worn by gentlemen's coachmen on a cold night, and in the summer he made a point of always blowing his nose just as he approached the door. Contrary to custom, this gentleman had not been watched, for, as the report ran that he was a person of high rank, and one who would allow no impertinent interference, his incognito was strictly respected. His visits were tolerably regular, though occasionally he appeared a little before or after his time, but generally, both in summer and winter, he took possession of his apartment about 4 o'clock, though he never spent the night there. At 3:30 in the winter, the fire was lighted by the discreet servant who had the superintendence of the little apartment, and in the summer, ices were placed on the table at the same hour. At 4 o'clock, as we have already stated, the mysterious personage arrived. 20 minutes afterwards, a carriage stopped at the house. A lady alighted in a black or dark blue dress, and always thickly veiled. She passed like a shadow through the lodge, and ran upstairs without a sound escaping under the touch of her light foot. No one ever asked her where she was going. Her face, therefore, like that of the gentleman, was perfectly unknown to the two concierges, who were, perhaps, unequalled throughout the capital for discretion. We need not say she stopped at the first floor. Then she tapped at a door in a peculiar manner, which, after being opened to admit her, was again fastened, and all was done. The same precautions were used in leaving as on entering the house. The lady always left first, and stepping into her carriage, it drove away, sometimes towards the right hand, sometimes the left. Then, about 20 minutes afterwards, the gentleman would also leave, buried in his cravat or concealed by his handkerchief. The day after Monte Cristo had called upon Danglars, the mysterious lodger entered at 10 o'clock in the morning instead of 4 in the afternoon. Almost directly afterwards, without the usual interval of time, a hackney coach arrived, and the veiled lady ran hastily upstairs. The door opened, but before it could be closed, the lady exclaimed, "Oh, Lucien! Oh, my friend!" The concierge, therefore, heard for the first time that the lodger's name was Lucien. Still, as he was the very perfection of a doorkeeper, he made up his mind not to tell his wife.